Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis, and so glad you could join me. My guest today is Paul Andrew Hutton, professor of history at the University of New Mexico, documentary writer, and award-winning Western author. He's here to talk about his best-selling book, The Apache Wars, The Hunt for Geronimo, The Apache Kid, and The Captive Boy, who started the longest war in American history. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Sure, of course. So when did you first discover your love of Western American history?
Oh, my goodness. You know, like a lot of people of my baby boomer generation, I got hooked on it through all the Western television shows that were on in the 1950s and 60s. And at one time, there were like 30 primetime TV shows that were Westerns back in the day when there were only three networks. And it was in particular, it was that Walt Disney Davy Crockett series, a little three-part show and a movie that came out as well that hooked me on history.
I'm a Gen X guy myself, but I remember the reruns as a kid, and especially the theme music. That was Fess Parker, right?
That was Fess Parker, yeah. Years later, I had I do museum exhibits as well sometimes. I did a big exhibit over in Texas at the Texas State History Museum on Davy Crockett, and Parker came as our special guest to the opening of the exhibit, which was a huge exhibit, and so I got to give him a private tour, which was a huge thrill. And I, of course, pretended to be, you know, a serious academic, but I was just turning inside. Here's my boyhood hero who had inspired my whole calling in life, and you know, he turned out to be, he's about 6'6". He's passed away a few years ago, but he was 6'6", about 80 years old, but tall and perfect, and to be around, just a great gentleman. So it was a real kick.
What was your first book in this genre? What got you interested in writing in it?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer. But I figured, you know, that the writing business being what it was even back in the 1970s, that I better have a day job. And so I wisely decided to become a college professor. And I just always loved history anyway. And so I got my PhD at the University of New Mexico. And my dissertation there was on Philip Sheridan, General Sheridan, who not only is a famous Civil War hero, but also commanded the Army in the West. And so my dissertation became my first book, called Phil Sheridan and His Army, which did very well in the academic world, won a bunch of prizes and kind of, you know, cemented me career-wise as an academic Western historian. But I always tried to write for a popular audience as well as trying to please my academic colleagues, which is kind of a interesting tap dance to do. And in fact, my very first two publications were couldn't have been more different, although they were both on General Custer, who was Sheridan's protege. One was in the Western Historical Quarterly, which was the leading scholarly journal in my field, Western history. And I was, in fact, first graduate student who ever published in that journal. But then my other one was in TV Guide, which at that time was the largest selling magazine in the world. couldn't have been more different. And that kind of started me on my Jekyll and Hyde career, where I've sort of bounced back and forth between the academy and popular history, although I've gone over pretty completely now to popular history.
So what was it about the Apache people? The culture, the history, what was it that inspired you to write a book about them?
Well, it's interesting because I had written quite a bit on the military frontier and the Indian Wars, but I had never really worked on the Apaches, concentrating mostly on the Great Plains, the Sioux Wars, the Cheyennes, and Arapahoes. And so the Apaches were sort of a new undertaking for me. There had been a broad literature on the Apaches published over the years. Some really great historians had worked on the Apaches, Dan Thrapp, Ed Sweeney. And so there was quite a bit of secondary material to draw on, but I did 3 years of research before I completed the book, so it was quite a chore. I came to the topic, though, for commercial reasons. My agent had called me after the success of Empire of the Summer Moon by S.C. Gwynne, which was kind of a surprise bestseller. And suddenly the folks back in New York all got interested in books on Indians. And so he called and suggested, actually, the Apache Wars as a topic, and off we went.
Interesting. So again, your book is really epic in scope. It covers a large cast of characters. It spans decades and decades. But I'd like to first ask you about the Apache people. How did they differ from other Native American tribes in the Southwest?
Well, interestingly, they had come late to the Southwest. And ironically, in Arizona in particular, not in New Mexico, but in Arizona, the Western Apaches may have arrived at about the same time or a little after Coronado was making his Spanish explorations through the area. So there's a certain irony in the fact that white explorers may have gotten here before the Apaches did. But they had come down the Front Range, migrated south. They're Athabascan speakers. They may have come south with the Navajo, and they were forced west by the Comanches out on the plains and split. Some of them migrated down the Rio Grande, and that became the Mescaleros in southeastern New Mexico, and the Chiricahuas, members people in southwestern New Mexico. And then others pushed further westward, came down through Arizona, and those became the Western Apaches that live in the mountains still of central Arizona. And they became the enemies of the folks who already were here in Arizona, the Pimas, the Papagos, the Tohono O'odham people, and in New Mexico, the Pueblos, and also the Hopis. And the Zunis, and eventually they became enemies of their cousins, the Navajos. And so intertribal warfare was just a constant during all this period. And the Apaches themselves were a raiding people. They're kind of the Vikings of America. And they lived by raiding. That's how they made their living. They live in a very inhospitable land. So they preyed upon their neighbors, and actually when the Spanish arrived in numbers, that was like a huge boon to the economy because it gave them new targets.
Are they a desert people?
Well, they're desert mountain people, in fact, it's interesting, they never became horseback Indians. They used horses, although they were just as likely to eat a horse as ride it. And horses were just not suited to the mountains in which the Apaches lived, both in New Mexico and in what's going to become Arizona. Some bands, like the Jicarillas in northern New Mexico, the Mescaleros down in southeastern New Mexico, did use horses more. And they, were closer to the Plains tribes. But the Chiricahuas and the western Apaches were not particularly horse Indians. They're tribal societies in very close-knit tribal societies. The family unit is the most important. And because of this, and because of the isolation that they lived in, they never were able to unite. And it was very rare that a leader could bring the diverse Apache bands together. Mangus Colorados was such a leader, Cochise also. But Geronimo, who's the most famous of the Apaches, did lead people from different bands, but mostly Chiricahuas. And he did not lead, you know, any kind of great coalition like Mangus Colorados put together.
So in the title of your book, you claim the Apache Wars was the longest war in American history. How do you define the longest war?
You know, and people, of course, have called me on that and said, now, really, the Seminole War down in Florida went on for a very long time as well. But the Apache Wars were almost continuous from 1861 on until 1886. And there had been some fighting in the 1850s. But there was a real connection between the beginning and the ending of those wars that we don't see in the other Indian wars that occurred in the United States. Although if we keep fooling around in Afghanistan, that's going to be the longest war in American history pretty quickly. But I chose to define it as the longest war because it really did retard settlement, white settlement, in Arizona and New Mexico, especially Arizona. And until Geronimo surrenders in 1886, and that's really the end of American Indian warfare and the sort of 300-year conflict between the European invader and the native people. Until he surrenders, there's going to be no progress on the frontier.
So again, because your title is so compelling, I want to go back to that. It says the captive boy that started the longest war in American history. Can you tell that story? Who was the captive boy and what role did he play in launching the Apache Wars?
Well, this character was really the one that drew me to the story, and I thought I could use him because of his involvement in the Apache War from the beginning to the end as a through character. Unfortunately, there wasn't as much paper on him. He was illiterate, so he never wrote any letters, and so it was kind of a tough research job to manage to pull out all of the threads of his involvement. But his name was Mickey Free, which is just a great name, and it comes from, in fact, a character in a British novel, a British military novel. And I'll relate that story in a second. But he was a young half Hispanic, half Irish boy named Felix Telles. His mother had married a pioneer down in southeastern Arizona named Johnny Ward in the 1850s. And young Mickey was about 12 years old when Coyotero Apaches, one of the bands of the Western Apaches, kidnapped him from his home in the Sonoyta Valley and carried him away. And Johnny Ward went to nearby Fort Buchanan and reported the kidnapping and demanded that troops, of course, retrieve his boy and his cattle that had also been taken. And Mickey was a little old. He was 12 at the time, but he was small for his age, scrawny, but he was a little old to be taken captive. The Apaches took a lot of captives, and there was a very active slave trade going on throughout the entire Southwest, and captives were valuable, but usually a 12-year-old boy was a little old to keep. and would have normally been killed, but there was something about him that attracted his kidnapper. It may have been the fact that he had lost an eye at an early age, and the man who led the raiding party, a warrior named Beto, also had one eye, and he carried the boy off, and he soon traded him away to the Western Apaches, who adopted him, treated him first as a slave, but then he quickly became a family member and became, you know, part of the Western Apache world. And so he grew up as this redheaded, he had red hair and freckles, redheaded Apache. But while all that was happening, this young lieutenant, George Bascom from Fort Buchanan, went with a detachment of troopers and Johnny Ward to the village of Cochise to demand that Cochise give up the kidnapped boy. Well, Cochise had nothing to do with the kidnapping. He said that, but Bascom took several of Cochise's relatives as prisoner and held them as hostage. And this incident, the Bascom Affair, as it came to be known, started the Apache War. And from that point on until 1886, the conflict rages, all because of the kidnapping of this this young boy. Later, when more troops come out and they begin to enlist Apache scouts, the boy enlists in the army, and because of his red hair and his freckles, he reminds the soldiers of this character from this old British novel that all of them had read as kids. And so they named him Mickey Free, and they gave all the Apache scouts various names because they couldn't pronounce their real names. And he became one of the most valuable and important of the scouts, and he became a translator for the army and for the government in dealings with the Apaches. So he became a pivotal figure, and it's interesting that he, the Apaches, especially the Chiricahuas, blamed him for starting the war because his kidnapping, you know, blaming the victim for what had happened, his kidnapping set the war in motion. And then the military never really trusted him either because he was so Apache. And so he's the perfect man in the middle who doesn't quite know who he is and searches for identity all through his life. But because he's so valuable, he's at almost every important event that transpires until the end, because Geronimo feared him. He wasn't in at the end when they finally captured Geronimo.
So where did his allegiances ultimately lie? With the United States government?
He retained his allegiance to the government and to the army, and he was well paid, you know, for those days as a first sergeant of scouts and also as a translator. In fact, he took an Apache delegation back and met President Grover Cleveland and translated in the White House. But at the very end, he went back. He left the military and he went back and to the Apache people, and he dies on the White Mountain Reservation just before the First World War. And so ultimately, he lived as an Apache.
What about Cochise? Would you mind talking about him and explaining the role he played at the beginning of the war?
Certainly, and he's just one of the great characters in American Western history. And, of course, I had fallen in love with that story as a kid. I saw the movie Broken Arrow with Jeff Chandler as Cochise and Jimmy Stewart as Tom Jeffords, and then read the novel Blood Brother by Elliot Arnold that it's based on. And I think it may have been the first kind of adult novel I ever read, you know, not that it's adult in that sense, it's just for grown-ups. And a great novel, just a fabulous, it was a bestseller, and it was made in this great movie. And the story was about the friendship between this white army scout, Tom Jeffords, and Cochise, the great chief of the Chiricahua Apache. And Cochise was the son-in-law of Mangus Colorados, and they had united after this Bascom Affair. They had united in warring against the whites, and at the same time, the Civil War broke out, and so most of the troops in Arizona and New Mexico were withdrawn. And in fact, settlers were thrown out of southeastern Arizona and had to, southwestern Arizona and had to retreat back to New Mexico. And so he waged a 10-year war, and then his friendship with Jeffords led to General Oliver O. Howard being able to give the Chiricahuas a reservation in their homeland and ending the conflict. Cochise then would die 5 years later. And once he died, the government, of course, promptly broke the treaty and removed the Chiricahuas to San Carlos. And Cochise's son then joined with Geronimo and began the series of breakouts that became the Geronimo Wars.
It must have been such an interesting time in that area of the world during the 1860s, 70s, 80s. You have so many different cultures meshing together, Americans, Mexicans, the Apaches, other indigenous tribes. It must have been quite the clash of cultures.
Well, it really was. And part of the story of the Apache Wars is also the wars down in Mexico. And one of the greatest of the Apache leaders, Victoria, was killed down in Mexico. But to the Apaches, northern Mexico and Sonora and Chihuahua were all part of, you know, what we could call Apacheria. And so the boundary line that's created by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and then later the Gadsden Purchase, well, that divides their territory. And then, of course, the United States government would divide it even further with these, you know, lines on paper and divide New Mexico territory into the territories of New Mexico and Arizona. And each of these had conflicting government jurisdictions. And so, obviously, it was difficult for the Apaches to, you know, negotiate with anyone. And then also, of course, they came to understand that the border provided them some sanctuary. Although the United States and Mexico finally reached agreements whereby U.S. troops pursued the Apaches deep into Mexico. And that was finally their undoing with the final Geronimo campaign. But it was very, very complicated. And then, of course, down in Arizona, the Tohono O'odham people, Pimas, Papagos, were also being attacked by the Apaches, and so they would join with the whites against the Apaches. Pueblos provided scouts against the Apaches. But finally, at the end, because the Apaches were so divided themselves, it was Apache scouts who tracked down Geronimo and brought an end to the Apache Wars.
It's such a complicated history in a way. You handle it really well in your book. They're called the Apache Wars, but there are multiple conflicts, one after another, right? All with their own plots and their own characters and their own motivations.
It is. The kind of two through characters I found that I could use were Mickey Free and Geronimo, both of whom are at the beginning, you know, all the way through to the end. But it is a complex story, and I'd like to think I made it pretty clear. Some folks have gotten a lot of nice commentary on the books, and some folks have written me and said, wow, it would have been nice if you perhaps had done a timeline as an appendix, or certainly a cast of characters as an appendix. I think that would have been a good idea, just because there are so many characters involved in the story. I think sometimes, especially, you know, white America thinks that Native peoples, you know, shared a common culture and shared a common identity, and that just wasn't the case. Even here amongst the Apache people, we find them so deeply divided. This shouldn't surprise us, considering that the Americans themselves had just engaged in a great civil war in which they killed 600,000 of each other. So Americans were divided as well, and the Apaches were the same way. It was very difficult to unite any of the, you know, tribal groups together in any part of American history. That's why remarkable Indian leaders like Pontiac, Tecumseh, Sitting Bull, Mangus Colorado's Cochise get our attention, because they were able to do something that not very many leaders could do
So yeah, this is a remarkable cast of characters. If you don't mind commenting on a few of them.
Sure.
Okay, I'd like to start with Mengus Coronatus. Who was he, and what role did he play in the wars?
Well, he's a great Chiricahua leader, and he is he lives at the headwaters of the Gila River, kind of where Silver City, New Mexico, is now, down in southwestern New Mexico, in the mountains. Beautiful area, just a gorgeous area. And that also is where Geronimo was from. And Mengus had three beautiful daughters, and in very much in European style, he married them off cleverly to important other Apache leaders. And this was one of the ways he was able to build this coalition and become such a leader. And the Mexicans had been hiring scalp hunters and providing bounties for Apache scalps. And this was really sort of organized terror. I mean, these bands of scalp hunters led by people like James Kirker numbered in the hundreds, and they would go out into Apache country and, you know, murder Apaches and take the scalps back. And this so enraged Mengus that he put together a great coalition of all the tribes, and they made life miserable for the folks in Sonora and Chihuahua, and in fact they almost depopulated the country. They could have if they wanted to, but you don't want to destroy the people that are providing you with a living, because they needed to raid down there to get cattle and sheep and the goods that they sold, including humans, that they sold to make a living. As Cochise once put it, in his negotiations with General Howard, he said, I can't negotiate till my men come back and they're down in Mexico making a living. So raiding. But Mengus, one of Mengus's daughters married Cochise, and so they were very close. And Mengus fought the Americans, but then attempted to make peace, and that was his undoing. He was betrayed by American officers and murdered after he had been captured. This really enraged Cochise and contributed to the ferocity of the attacks that the Apaches launched against the Americans. They closed the Butterfield stage line. They depopulated south eastern Arizona and kind of besieged Tucson. It was really really something, one of the few times in American history where the American frontier is thrown back. But then California troops come in and sort of reinforce folks. They're on their way, of course, to fight the Confederates, because the Americans are divided as well. Young Bascom, who started the whole thing, is killed, in fact, at the Battle of Val Verde, fighting Confederate invaders in New Mexico. So it's just a real violent time and a very complicated time. And Mengus is one of the most prominent of the early casualties of the conflict. His name, Red Sleeves, it was said, came from the long white shirt he wore, and as he waded into the Mexicans that he slaughtered, it was turned red, and that's how he got his name.
Wow. So you said that the Apaches' way of life depended on raiding other tribes. Do you think this benefited them in their fight against the government, or do you think this isolated them against the tribes they had already decimated in the area?
Right. Well, certainly they didn't have many friends, and in fact their name means enemy in Zuni. That's how they got their name, Apache. They had alienated many of the native peoples in the area, and of course they had through this 200 years of conflict, you know, it had led to many blood scores with Mexico. The Americans don't get out here until the 1850s, and then in very small numbers. New Mexico is fairly well settled, but only along the Rio Grande Corridor for the most part, and maybe 40,000 people in New Mexico at the end of the Mexican War. maybe 500 people in what is now Arizona. So there's not a large population. And so for the longest time, the Americans and the Apaches got along because there wasn't much conflict. And by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, we were supposed to stop Apache raids into Mexico, but there was a lot of winking and nodding that went on with that. And, of course, the Apaches would raid into Mexico. They'd sell their goods up in Mesilla and other New Mexico towns, and that's how they made their living. If you're essentially making your living as a pirate, you got to have someone who's going to buy the stuff from you. And when they raided in the United States, of course, they just went down to into Mexico, into Sonora, and sold the goods down there. So everyone was kind of complicit in this business that was going on, but they were just incredible fighters. General Crook, who fought them, called them the tigers of the human species. They knew the land. They knew the land intimately. It was their ally in their conflict. They were superb. Although they were poorly armed, they managed, of course, to fight off the Americans for 25 years, which is pretty remarkable.
How did they use the land to their advantage in fighting their enemies?
Well, of course, they're mountain people. They know where every water hole is, and water is life out here in the West. And they knew where the water was. They also knew the native vegetation so well. They knew how to use that to their advantage. They, of course, had no permanent villages. They're nomadic in the sense that they moved with the seasons and they moved around as particular natural plants would ripen and they would harvest them. They did some rudimentary agriculture, some corn, that sort of thing, but not much. But so they really knew the land, and they knew all of the land, all the way from northern Arizona all the way down into central Mexico. And they knew all the hiding places, and if you visit the country that they roamed through, it's just astonishing that they were ever caught. And that's why the Apache scouts themselves were so valuable, because they also knew where the water holes were. And so they knew there were only so many places where you could camp. They knew there were only so many kind of favored places to set up villages. And that's how, of course, eventually the Apaches were conquered. But it was a very, very difficult and prolonged war. And they were masters at guerrilla warfare, even though it didn't have a name at that time. And they didn't take scalps. They also didn't rape. They're a very puritanical people. And so all those old movies are wrong. Fate worse than death was facing any white woman taken by the Apaches. And they never took scalps because they have a real fear of the dead and of touching the dead. And so they didn't take body parts, but they were masters at torture. And to be taken by the Apaches was really a grim fate indeed. And they really struck terror into the hearts of their enemies because of what they did to male prisoners that they took and tortured to death.
I have to ask you, how did they torture their enemies? What unique techniques did they use?
Oh, my goodness. They would tie people up, sort of the small trees we have out here, so that their head was just above a small fire that they would build, and they would cook their brains. They would lay people out and put sweet substances on them, pry their mouths open so that insects would crawl inside and devour them. They would bury people up to their necks in fire ant holes. And they would use various, cactus to torture folks as well. It was pretty grim stuff, But it was a grim, grim world then. And I'm often charmed by, you know, the Europeans came, you know, to the New World in the 1500s in great numbers. And, you know, they called the Indians savages. And, of course, it's the same time, you know, the Inquisition is going on. And in England, if you're a traitor, you're disemboweled and cut into four pieces. I mean, so folks had different sensibilities, to say the least, on both sides. But nevertheless, you know, if you're a trooper in the U.S. Cavalry and you see one of your buddies, laid out like this, it made a deep impression on you. So folks were that old movie cliche about saving the last bullet for yourself. That was really true. Folks really did.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906. When a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Your book is so expansive, and we obviously can't cover everything.
Yes, of course.
But I'd love it if you could maybe pick out a battle that you found especially interesting, maybe one that turned the tide for a particular side.
Well, one of the great battles, it was a very early one, and it was one of the few times where the Apaches, because there are so few Apaches, I mean, there are only 8,000 Apaches during this whole period, so it's not a large population, and they're divided, of course. So, you know, this isn't 200, 300, 400, you know, warriors being thrown at army detachments or at forts, like you see in the movies. But there was the Battle at Apache Pass, which occurred when California troops under General James Carleton were coming east to fight the rebels who had invaded New Mexico. Well, first they had to get past the Apaches, and the rebels had actually pushed into Arizona and occupied Tucson. And so the Apaches were fighting both the rebels and the Yankees at the same time, and there's even a crazy episode in which pioneers from Arizona are retreating to the east, and the U.S. Army has abandoned them, and rebel troops ride to the rescue and save them when their wagon train is attacked by the Apaches. You just can't make this stuff up. But the Battle of Apache Pass occurred as U.S. troops were moving through Apache Pass, and that's just to the east of Tucson. It's actually right off I-10. You can see it as you drive by, although I dare say most folks don't notice it. And it was an important way station because of the springs that were there. And it that had been where the Bascom Affair had taken place and where Cochise's relatives had been hanged. And so troops were moving through there, and they were ambushed by Cochise and Mangus Colorados and pinned down, and it was a very, very close affair. But in one of the few occasions in all of Indian warfare where artillery was important, the Californians had artillery with them, and they used that to dislodge the Apaches. And in that fight, at the very end of that fight, a small band of couriers were being pursued by a band of Apaches, and one of the horses went down, and this courier decided to sell his life as dearly as he could, and took aim at the leading Apache coming right at him, and shot him off out of his off his horse. Well, that turned out to be Mangus Colorados, who was gravely wounded and almost died. They took him down to Mexico and at gunpoint forced a doctor to operate on him and save him. And that's what kind of led Mangus to decide to sue for peace after that episode. So that single shot at the Battle of Apache Pass really kind of turned the tide against the Apaches and led to Mangus Colorados trying to make peace with the Americans, but of course didn't work because they killed him.
That was in what year?
That is in 1862.
Okay, so that happened pretty early on in the Apache Wars.
Very early on, yeah. And Mangus attempts to make peace. General Carleton essentially orders him killed, and he's murdered after when he comes in to negotiate. And then that ends any chance of peace. And then Cochise is on the warpath for 10 more years.
How does Cochise meet his end?
Cochise dies. They think it may have been stomach cancer. Hard to say. But he essentially dies of old age. We don't know when he was born, but he was certainly in his 70s. And so was Mangus Colorados when he died. That was an important death for the Apache people because as long as he lived, the peace had held. But once he died, the government moved quickly to dispossess the Apaches and move them out of their country down in southeastern Arizona and put them on the San Carlos Reservation.
And that was a forced march, right?
Yeah, they were essentially surrounded by troops, and they had no hope to make any kind of settlement. And this is what led to Geronimo breaking out, and it led Naiche, Cochise's son, to finally join Geronimo. And so that was critical. Geronimo was not a hereditary chief. That was passed down. So Naiche was the leader of the Chiricahuas, and the fact that he went out with Geronimo gave, Geronimo a lot of clout. Geronimo was a spiritual leader, and he was just a great warrior. And his fame as a warrior is what led many to follow him.
Had the tribe been getting pushed west by this point, or were they being herded into a specific area?
Yes, and the reason they put them at San Carlos, which is kind of a low, almost malarial kind of area on the Gila River, was that it would be easy to resupply, and they knew eventually the railroad was going to go right through there. And so it was all an economy measure. It's just the government trying to save money. And they wanted to consolidate all the Apaches in one place. And after the Civil War, that became essentially the Indian policy of the United States government. Consolidate all the tribes in one place, segregate them from the whites, allegedly work them toward becoming civilized farmers, as the line was, in that time, destroy their culture and assimilate them eventually into American society. And so San Carlos was the center point in Arizona where the Apaches were to be gathered. John Clum was the agent there, who also is a fabulous sort of Western character. He later becomes mayor of Tombstone, hires Wyatt Earp as the marshal, and is involved in all the OK Corral troubles down in southern Arizona. But putting the Apaches all together was a huge mistake because they didn't get along. And, of course, to the government, an Apache was an Apache was an Apache. But San Carlos became sort of a nest of old feuds and quarrels and So it became a very unhappy place. And it was unhealthy, and it wasn't a good climate for mountain people. I mean, they live up in the mountains for a reason. The air's better. It's, you know, cooler. And we now know in Arizona there's this crazy thing called valley fever, which is which comes from dust in the area and sickens people all the time. And these fevers killed hundreds of Apaches after they were consolidated there at San Carlos. And so that just added to their discontent.
So this consolidation, is this what brings Cochise and Geronimo together?
Absolutely, yeah. They, of course, had known each other before, but they had actually fought each other before. Because Geronimo, even after Cochise made peace, Geronimo wasn't going to keep the peace. And he and his fellow warrior, fellow named Wo, continued to raid into Mexico and occasionally up into the United States. And at one time, Taza and Aiche, the sons of Cochise, battled Geronimo and worked with Tom Jeffords, who was the Indian agent. And after Cochise died, the government immediately fired Jeffords, who was a little too cozy with the Indians for the, you know, to make the government happy. And Jeffords never would have gone along with moving the Indians to San Carlos, so he had to go. And so that just contributed all the more to the dissatisfaction of the natives, you know, with their lot. I mean, you can't blame them for what they do. On the other hand, of course, you're not going to be able to continue to keep raiding like you had in the past. Those days were over. But the constant and unrelenting betrayal of these people by the United States government and essentially by bureaucrats who are just making policy is just infuriating.
Is there a particular event that turns Geronimo into a heroic figure for his people?
Well, there was a particular event that turned him into an implacable warrior, and that was Llanos in Mexico was one of the great trading centers where the Apaches would go, and they would go down to Llanos, and they would sell their sell the goods they had stolen, sell captives, and trade. And they're down there, and Mexican militia troops from a different area were in pursuit of these Apaches. And while Geronimo and the others were negotiating in Llanos, their village, unbeknownst to them, was assaulted, and all the women and children were murdered. And this included Geronimo's wife, his two children, and his mother. And this set him on the warrior path. He was a warrior to begin with, but now he just became implacable. And when he was near death, he was asked if he had any regrets in life, and he said, "Yes, I'm sorry I didn't kill more Mexicans." So this is a man who really followed the vengeance trail. In that way, he's kind of the perfect Western hero, the one who won't compromise, the one who just pursues violence, for its own end, and it becomes his life.
You've already stated that the final chapter to this war between the United States government and the Apache people, it ends with more of a sputter than anything else, right?
It does, actually. Geronimo and just a handful of people, really under 50, are all that are holding out, but they're making life miserable on both sides of the border. General Crook manages to get him to come in, and Crook had a pretty good relationship on and off with Geronimo, and he convinces Geronimo to surrender, and Crook made some promises to Geronimo that he knew he wouldn't be able to live up to, or I guess he thought he had enough influence that he could overrule the Secretary of War and General Phil Sheridan, who was his commander, because Sheridan wanted Geronimo hanged, and they were going to remove the Apache people. There was a lot of talk of putting him in the Indian Territory, Oklahoma, at that time. Well, Crook promised Geronimo that they could, just go back to San Carlos and they could stay in Arizona. And he wasn't able to deliver on that. And when Geronimo got nervous about this deal, he bolted at the last minute. Unfortunately for Crook, he had already wired Washington, D.C., claiming that he had captured Geronimo. And so that cost him his job. He was replaced by General Nelson Miles. Miles used Crook's Apache scouts effectively to convince Geronimo to come in. But the way they did it was essentially to remove all of the Chiricahua people and send them to Florida. And it's sort of ironic when you think about the Trail of Tears and Indian removal in the 1830s and 40s. They took all the Indians from the east and put them in, you know, the west. In Oklahoma, here they are taking the Apaches, the Chiricahua Apaches, and removing them to Florida, and they imprisoned them there. Well, so essentially what you've done is you've kidnapped their families. And so that was the final blow. And Miles promised Geronimo that he would save his life, that he wouldn't let the folks in Arizona hang him. And he did live up to that, again, disobeying orders, because Sheridan wanted Geronimo hanged. And a lot of people believe Geronimo deserved to hang. But nevertheless, they were all put on trains and taken to Florida. And interestingly, as the trains moved east, Geronimo became more and more of a hero. Finally, they were removed to Fort Sill in the Indian Territory in Oklahoma. And Geronimo was allowed to go on the fair circuit, and he appeared in several world's fairs, and he sold his autograph, and he would sell, you know, Indian trinkets and bows and arrows, and he made a fortune for those days. It was said he had $10,000 in the bank when he died. He appeared in Teddy Roosevelt's inaugural parade in 1906. It was just incredible, his transformation from one of the most feared men in America into an American hero. But we have a habit of doing that, taking the bad boys and making them into heroes. Billy the Kid here in New Mexico being another fine example. So Geronimo kind of has a happy ending. I mean, he asked President Roosevelt to return him to his homeland so he could die in Arizona. Roosevelt said he couldn't do it because someone would kill him, and he's probably right. But Geronimo did live in some comfort in his final years.
So now, in 2019, where is the largest concentration of Apache people? In Florida?
No, the Apaches were imprisoned in Florida. Then they were removed eventually to first Alabama and then to Oklahoma, southwestern Oklahoma, where Fort Sill is. And there they were kept as prisoners of war until Geronimo died. They are, in fact, this was brought up to me once when I was giving a book talk by an Apache woman. She said, you know, we hear all this talk about the internment of the Japanese during World War II. She says, but the people that were imprisoned as prisoners of war the longest time were my people, the Chiricahua people. And she's absolutely right, from 1886 to 1909. And then they were offered the remaining Chiricahuas were offered the choice of either moving back to New Mexico to the Mescalero Reservation, which is down in the mountains of southern New Mexico, or of taking up homesteads there in Oklahoma. And so they divided. And most of the people went to Mescalero, went to New Mexico, but many of them stayed in Oklahoma, and they became the Fort Sill Apaches. And they have recently been attempting to come back to their homeland, which is, you know, the mountains around Silver City, New Mexico, and they'd like to open a casino down on I-10, and they would like to restore their homeland and bring Geronimo back. He's buried at Fort Sill, bring him back and bury him in his homeland. And so there's quite a controversy out here over their attempt to purchase land. They don't want anything from the government. They'll purchase the land and establish a casino and reestablish their homeland here. So That's going on today. So the repercussions out here in Indian country are still very much alive from the Apache Wars.
I've got a final question. I can't forget to ask you about the Apache Kid. A fascinating character in a book full of fascinating characters. Could you talk about the Apache Kid, who he was and how he became such a legendary figure in Western lore?
Well, I loved the Apache Kid story because he was such a counterpoint to Mickey Free. So Mickey Free is a, you know, white boy raised by the Apaches, who becomes, you know, this famous Apache scout. And the Apache Kid was an Apache raised by whites who also becomes an Apache scout. But both of them are finally confronted in life with having to make a decision. Who are you? Are you a white person? Are you an Apache? And when the Apache Kid's father is killed in a drunken brawl with another Apache, he seeks vengeance and kills that, the man who killed his father. Well, this gets him in trouble with the government, even though he had been, along with Mickey Free, the top Apache scout. And he was a great favorite of Al Sieber, who was the white chief of scouts. And he came in to surrender after killing the man who killed his father. And there was a confrontation. Shots were fired, and Sieber was terribly wounded in this, and there was a breakout, and the Apache Kid broke out. Eventually, he was captured, brought back in. He agreed to surrender, and he was sentenced to, of all places, Alcatraz, which was used as a federal prison for Indians at the time, and spent 2 years in Alcatraz before he was brought back to Arizona and set at liberty by the courts. Who ruled that his trial had been illegal, technically. Well, then he was rearrested. Sieber was determined to put him behind bars. Rearrested, sentenced to Yuma Prison in Arizona, which was almost a death sentence, and escaped in his daring escape on the stage to Yuma, and then became the terror of the Southwest for another 10 years and eventually vanished into the mountains of Mexico, never captured, and sort of riding on, you know, as the heroic last Apache, the last Apache warrior to resist the whites.
And he was involved in something called the Kelvin Grade Massacre, right?
Well, that was the stagecoach he was on that was taking him. Kelvin Grade was a place where the grade was so steep that everyone had to get out and walk so the stage could make it up the hill. And the kid and the other Apache prisoners took that opportunity to overpower their guards, killed the sheriff and his deputy, terribly wounded the driver of the stage, and escaped. And so that, as you can imagine, became a huge event. And there was a several thousand dollar reward on the kid's head. And posses were all over Arizona and New Mexico looking for him. And, you know, $5,000, $10,000 in the 1890s is a lot of money. And Mickey Free went looking for him, even though they had once been close friends. Tom Horn, the famous gunfighter who had once been an Apache scout in the Apache Wars, also tried to hunt him down, but no one could ever catch him. He remained very, very elusive and sort of vanished into the mist of history.
There were multiple people, right, that claimed to have killed him. Do you put any stock in any of those stories? Does one sound more realistic than the others? Or do you just throw up your hands and say, we don't really have any idea?
Well, all of the accounts by folks in the United States seem not to be authentic. But indeed, there were a lot of Mormon settlements down in northern Mexico. They had fled down to northern Mexico because of the polygamy troubles. And when the church had finally outlawed polygamy, a lot of folks moved to Mexico. If you recall, when Mitt Romney's father ran for president, George Romney, he had actually been born in one of those settlements down in Mexico, and so there was some question whether he was an American citizen or not. That's how recent all this is. But nevertheless, the kid and his band preyed on these Mormon settlements, and he and his wife may well have been killed in a fight. A Norwegian explorer trying to find this so-called lost, tribe of Apaches in the Sierra Madre interviewed a woman who may well have been the Apache kid's daughter. And this just seems like the most logical of all the tales. And the raids stopped. There were no more raids after this. But there were, the Apache kid wasn't the only Apache who fled down into the Sierra Madre, and so it's not impossible that those folks weren't, the Apache kid and his wife. But it does seem to be the most logical of all the stories.
Well, you've written so many articles, so many books. How can we direct people right to you and to everything you've done?
Well, I do have a website. Just go to, paulhutton.com, and of course, although as a defender of independent bookstores, it pains me, I still, just have to say that it's so easy to find all my publications at amazon.com, and there's a link, on my, for the Apache Wars book, there's a link that takes you right to my site, and all of my publications are listed there, and I just signed on Monday, a new contract with Dutton, which is part of Random House, just like Crown was, for my next book, which is due in 18 months, kind of daunting, which is going to be sort of my dream project, a big history of the American West from the Revolution to 1890. I call it the Undiscovered Country.
And, oh, my goodness. Wow.
I'm going to lock myself away and one of my friends is Hampton Sides, the very successful writer, and he calls it the Cave of Pain. So lock myself away in the cave and write this book. But I'm very excited about it because this is kind of a dream book for me. And I'm going to use the lives of seven Americans, four white sort of Western heroes, Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, Kit Carson, and Buffalo Bill. And then three native leaders, Red Eagle, the leader of the Creeks, Mangus Colorados, the Apache leader, and Sitting Bull, and kind of weave the story through their lives like I tried to do with the Apache Wars, through the lives of Mickey Free, the Apache Kid, Cochise, and others.
Anything about Mike Fink?
I'll work Mike Fink into that Davy Crockett section. Back in the 50s, they actually made one of the Davy Crockett shows was Davy Crockett's encounter with Mike Fink on the Mississippi, which was a great influence on me as a kid. And Mike Fink was a fascinating character, and he's actually connected with the fur trade of the far west of the Rocky Mountains because he's taking goods up the Missouri, and that's where he finally meets his end. He gets killed up there in a duel. So, larger-than-life characters, but the story of the West is that kind of story, and to me it's kind of the story of America. It's what makes us unique from other peoples, and of course I find it a romantic and colorful story, but also tragic at the same time. And my title comes from the Undiscovered Country isn't because somebody's discovering something. The Undiscovered Country is from Hamlet's soliloquy. It's kind of the dual edge of both triumph and tragedy. That's the story of the West, and that's what I hope to capture in this book.
Well, this has been so great. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it very much.
Again, I've been talking to author Paul Andrew Hutton about his best-selling book, The Apache Wars, The Hunt for Geronimo, The Apache Kid, and The Captive Boy Who Started the Longest War in American History. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe time. tomorrow.